Thank you very much, Peter. I'd like to say it's a pleasure to be here, but I'm not sure it's a good look in these difficult economic times for a central banker to be at bankruptcy conferences. But nonetheless, the main theme of my talk today is really to say that things are not really that bad. So I thought I was going to I'd talk about how household finances are going. Because the extraordinary developments in global financial markets over the past couple of months have understandably undermined households' confidences in their finances. This has occurred around the world. Households have seen incredible volatility in financial prices. Daily movements in the share market of several percentage points have become the norm. Share prices have fallen significantly around the globe. In Australia, the market is down about 40% this year, as I'm sure you're aware. And this has resulted in negative returns on most individuals' superannuation funds. The difficulties in the global interbank markets that had existed since August last year took a dramatic turn for the worse last month. The crisis, which had until then been largely confined to the wholesale markets, spilled over into a severe loss of confidence amongst retail investors in financial intermediaries. Governments around the world have been forced to offer wide-ranging guarantees on banks' liabilities. And to top it off, some commentators are now predicting sharp falls in house prices in Australia. So there's a lot of gloom and doom around. And so it's easy for households to lose perspective of exactly what their position is. I thought it'd be useful in these circumstances to take an objective look at the state of household finances. And I will focus on three key areas. One is household income, the second is household finances, household balance sheets, and the third is the housing market. In particular, is the Australian housing market going to go the same way as the US market? The first thing to say about household income is that the past 5 years have been an extraordinarily favourable period. You can see from this chart here that real household disposable income grew on average by about 6.1% per year over the past 5 years. This has resulted in a cumulative increase over the 5 years of more than 30%. One has to go back more than 30 years to find a bigger increase over a five-year period. Periods of strong income growth tend to be periods of strong spending, and it is the job of central banks to try and keep a lid on this to prevent excessive inflation. The past 5 years were therefore also a period of rising interest rates. Some commentators would have us believe that this had a crippling effect on the household sector's finances. While there's no doubt that there were some households who were severely affected by this, the facts show that this was not the case for the household sector as a whole. Even after allowing for the effects of higher interest payments, real household disposable income over the 5 years still increased by more than 25%. This increase too was the largest since the early 1970s. Put another way, over the past 5 years, the amount of money that households had left over to spend after paying taxes and interest on all their loans grew in real terms at the fastest rate in over 30 years. As I say, this was a truly extraordinary period. Now, what contributed to this surge in incomes? Now, as usual, there is a number of factors at work. First, wage and salary income grew on average by about 7.5% a year. Income from investments grew by 17% a year. This is just due to higher dividends and higher interest payment on bank deposits. It doesn't include the very strong capital gains that people also made on their shares. Taxes payable grew less than income because we were given a series of tax cuts. This meant that disposable income grew more quickly than gross income, on average by about 8.3% a year. Inflation, as measured by the consumption deflator, ate up about 2.2% a year of this income growth. So this left the disposable income growing at the figure of 6.1% that I mentioned earlier. This growth in household incomes in Australia far exceeded that in any other developed economy. In the US, for example, growth in real household disposable income was only about half the rate in Australia. It's also interesting to note that the growth in income in Australia was fairly evenly distributed amongst the household sector. The percentage increase in real income was very similar across all the income quintiles. In short, the boom in Australia was very strong by world standards, and a high proportion of Australian households shared in it. These facts help us to understand how we got to where we are. But the more relevant question is, where are we heading over the next 5 years? I think it is now widely accepted that growth in real incomes over the next year or two will be more subdued than over the past 5 years. How subdued will depend importantly on the effects of the financial turmoil. Nobody knows how significant these effects will turn out to be, but I think it would be reasonable to assume that income growth for the household sector will be noticeably below average over the next year or two. Beyond the next couple of years, the future is harder to predict. But there's no reason at this stage to doubt that past patterns will be repeated and that growth will pick up again. Australia remains, after all, a very dynamic economy. The outcomes in Australia will, as usual, be influenced to some extent by global developments. At present, the major developed economies seem to be moving into recession. They do this every 7 to 10 years. The last such recession was in 2001, so the recession that's emerging at present seems to be pretty much on cue. The Reserve Bank has been factoring weaker global economic growth into its policy assessment for much of this year. Throughout this period, we have been forecasting slower growth than the major international forecasters. Even so, the events of the past couple of months have caused us to revise down our forecast for world economic growth even further. Australia managed to sidestep the 2001 global recession, and the question is, can it do it again this time? Well, that is certainly what we are aiming for, and there's nothing in the data to date to suggest that we are off track. But the economy has been affected by powerful forces from different directions, and it is unclear what the net effect of these will be. The impact of the global developments is particularly uncertain. We also have to recognise that the task of managing the economy this time will be more difficult than in 2001 because we are starting with a bigger inflation overhang. The bank has for some time thought that inflation would peak in the second half of 2008 and then fall. Accordingly, we have acted preemptively in reducing interest rates. Nonetheless, there's still a big task ahead to bring inflation down, and this could limit room for manoeuvre on monetary policy. Many people will be disappointed and unhappy with a year or two of below average economic performance. But the truth is that the economy cannot always grow above average, and it certainly cannot maintain the pace of the past 5 years. If we attempted to make it do so, we would be repeating the mistakes of our predecessors from the 1960s, whose attempts to maintain a never-ending economic boom laid the foundations for the subsequent two decades of severe economic difficulties. One of the factors that helped keep Australia from following the developed economies into recession in 2001 was our increase in links with Asia and China in particular. These links have strengthened further since 2001, and China is now our largest trading partner. It would be naive of us to assume that China will not experience an economic cycle itself, and so we should expect that its demand for our resources will fluctuate. However, China's long-term growth potential is very strong, and this must be a source of optimism about our own long-term prosperity, given that we are one of its major suppliers of raw materials. I'd like to turn now to the household balance sheet. Australians have much bigger holdings of financial assets than financial liabilities. Financial assets at 30th of June averaged about $275,000 per household, while liabilities averaged about $150,000 per household. Since then, We estimate that average assets have fallen to around $245,000 because of what's happened in markets. This is, nonetheless, though, still a strong position. The composition of assets and liabilities is very different. You can see from this chart that liabilities consist mainly of borrowings from the banks and other lenders, where the value is fixed and on which regular interest has to be paid. Household assets, on the other hand, consist mainly of market-linked investments. This balance sheet structure is very favourable in terms of maximising long-run accumulation of wealth, because the return on these assets over long terms exceeds the cost of debt by a substantial margin. The returns do not, however, accumulate evenly from year to year. Some years produce very strong returns, while others produce negative returns. We are currently going through one of these periods of negative returns. As I mentioned, the share market has fallen sharply this year. Largely because of this, the typical superannuation fund, a balance fund, experienced a negative return of about 8% last financial year. Returns are again negative this financial year to date. Naturally, people find this very distressing, but it's not the first time this has happened. Over the past 100 years, the share market, on average, has had negative returns every 5 years. The sharp fall in share prices since late last year certainly is confronting, but the thing that needs to be kept in mind is that it was preceded by 4 years of extremely strong returns. As such, even after this year's fall, anybody who had held shares for the past 5 years would still have earned a return of 8% per annum on average. This is still more than the return on government bonds or bank deposits. The uneven pattern in share market returns partly reflects the economic cycle and partly reflects the influence of human behaviour. As investors, we find it difficult to distinguish the cycle from the trend. In particular, after a few years, a cyclical upswing starts to look like a trend to many of us, and we tend to jump aboard. Eventually, this pushes asset prices to levels that are much higher than can be sustained by the underlying income produced by those assets, and the consequence is the prices eventually correct down again. Investments in shares tend to compensate the holder for short-term volatility in returns by producing higher returns over the long run. If they didn't do this, nobody would invest in them. These higher returns can compound up to very large amounts over time. As an illustration of this, let's assume that somebody had $100 in today's money to invest 100 years ago. If they put this money in government bonds, and assuming all the interest that they received was reinvested in bonds along the way, the investment would today be worth about $800. This is an annual real return of 2%, so we've taken inflation out of this. If that money had instead been put in the Australian share market, and again assuming all the dividends were reinvested in shares, it would today be worth about $130,000, a significantly higher amount. The return on this, in real terms, was about 7%. The difference in returns between these two investments, 5 percentage points a year in real terms, is the risk premium that investors have received for investing in the share market. At present, the risk premium is higher than this because investors have become very nervous. The increase in the risk premium demanded by investors has been an important factor causing the share market to fall in recent months. The one-year forward earning yields on Australian shares at present has risen to about 11%. This is well above the long-run average. It's also a very attractive yield. When the yield has risen to these levels in the past, the return on shares over the subsequent 10 years has almost always been well above average. Finally, I'd like to turn to the housing market. Some commentators who have looked at the US housing market feel that they've seen the future for the Australian market. In some ways, this is understandable because economic developments in Australia have in the past often mirrored those in the US. As you know, the ratio of housing costs to income has been unusually high in recent years, and I don't think it's unreasonable to expect that it will decline over time. But this ratio can adjust in several ways. It can be due to lower house prices, or it can be due to rising incomes, or it can be due to falling interest rates. In the US recently, the falls in house prices have been the big part of the adjustment. I think there are good reasons, however, to believe that the Australian housing market will not follow the US to the same degree, and I want to run through some of those now. First, the cycle in the Australian housing market, rather than following the US market, is in fact at a more advanced stage. It's probably leading the US market by about 3 years or so. The Australian housing market was at its hottest in 2003, whereas the US market peaked in 2006. To understand how this came about, it's necessary to look back to the second half of the 1990s. The tremendous shift in the global saving investment balance that took place after the Asian financial crisis generated a surplus of funds in global markets. The financial sectors in the English-speaking countries, being more dynamic and responsive than those in many other countries, were quick to take advantage of this. In the US, the early part of this period coincided with a surge in technological innovation, and the initial wave of money in that country went to the technology sector. This resulted in the tech bubble, which eventually collapsed in 2000. In Australia, we did not have much of a technology-producing sector, so our institutions sought out other investment opportunities. What Australia did have was a conservative household sector with relatively low gearing. As such, the financial sector saw opportunities for financial innovation and aimed at encouraging households to make greater use of their borrowing capacity. Much of this was focused on housing lending. The result was that the boom in Australian housing got underway well before that in the US, because the latter really did not start till after the tech bubble crashed in 2000. A second difference relates to the dynamics of the housing markets in the two countries. In the US, the rise in house prices elicited a very strong supply response, so that by the end of 2007, there was almost 1 year's supply of newly built unsold houses overhanging the market. House prices in the US essentially stopped rising because the supply of houses overtook demand. Here in Australia, the rise in house prices did not elicit such a strong supply response. There were pockets of overdevelopment in apartments in 2003 and 2004, but by and large, there was never a serious oversupply of unsold houses in Australia. In fact, the consensus is that there's currently a shortage of dwellings. The Australian housing boom basically ended because house prices rose to levels that severely strained the capacity of buyers to pay higher prices, not because too many houses were built, as was the case in the US. The overhang of unsold houses in the US has created downward pressure on house prices as builders and developers have been forced to sell. This is absent in Australia. Rather, the shortage of housing means that there are buyers waiting for better circumstances, for example, lower interest rates or rising incomes, to facilitate their entry to the market. This latent underlying demand for housing will support the market. A third important difference between Australia and the US is in the groups that the lenders targeted and in the loans terms that they had on offer. In Australia, the lending boom was concentrated on existing homeowners who traded up to bigger and better houses and bought investment properties. Many of these people were in their 40s and 50s who had previously very low levels of debt. At the end of the boom, the home ownership rate in Australia was no different to that at the start, in both cases about 70%. While one could argue that no socially productive purpose was served by this increase in lending to middle-aged existing homeowners, it did mean that the loans largely went to those who had a strong capacity to service them and repay them. As a result, whereas most other countries with housing booms have experienced a strong rise in arrears once the boom ended, in Australia, the arrears rate today is no different to what it was at the start of the boom in the 1990s. And of course, it's very low by international standards. In the United States, in contrast, a lot of the lending found its way to more marginal borrowers who previously could not afford a loan, or the lending took the form of very aggressively structured mortgages, which allowed people to borrow much more than they previously could. the home ownership rate in the US continued to rise during the first few years of the boom. Now, one could argue that this was a very good thing, but one consequence was that a significant proportion of this group ended up having trouble servicing their loans, hence the sharp rise we've seen in US loan delinquencies. In setting out these differences, I don't want to leave the impression that the Australian housing market is without its problems. There's no denying that there is a significant number of people who are facing difficulties with their housing loan repayments, especially in the western suburbs of Sydney, where the arrears rates are significantly higher than in other parts of the country. While lending standards in Australia did not deteriorate to anywhere near the same extent as in the US, loans sourced from new non-traditional lenders have ended up with higher arrears rates than those from traditional lenders. The arrears rates, even on prime full documentation loans made by this new group of lenders, are running at about three times higher than those on similar loans from the major banks. In addition, a higher proportion of loans granted by these new lenders were low-doc loans or non-conforming loans, the arrears rates on which are significantly higher than those on prime loans. One can only conclude that these lenders had lower credit standards than traditional lenders, and while this may have benefited some borrowers initially, it has also ended up causing significant hardship for others. One of the issues that has been highlighted by the events in the US is the importance of having adequate regulation of lending and loan brokers. And I think it's good to see the initiatives that have been taken recently here in Australia to strengthen further the regulation of this industry put that in on an even better footing than it currently is. Let me conclude by saying that we are going through some uncertain financial times at present, and this is leading some to question whether the period of prosperity that has been running for almost two decades has come to an end. While nobody can predict accurately what all that lies ahead, it's important not to become too pessimistic because, fundamentally, household finances and the economy more generally remain in good shape. The main problem that has built up, namely inflation, is manageable and is being dealt with. The next couple of years will be noticeably more subdued than the past five. We should not be surprised by this because the income and wealth generated over the past 5 years was simply extraordinary. By definition, the economy must grow at a below average pace for some of the time. These periods provide the economy with the breathing space to sustain the expansion. There's no reason to assume that the next year or two will not do the same. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Battaglino. That has been a fantastic beginning when we look at our theme, unravelling the complexities. We need to understand the issues, we need to understand the historical context, and in a bumper sticker sense, I suppose the message is don't panic. And accordingly, at morning tea time, when we break from here, there won't be lifeboat drill outside. Now, I said earlier that Mr. Battaglino is quite willing to take questions from the floor, from delegates. We have some microphones roving, and I would ask that you give us your name and your sector or background or wherever you're from so that we can better understand the context in which you pose your question. I'm going to identify two people at a time, and the gentleman there with the blue shirt, his hand up for number one, and that gentleman there, secondly, that gentleman there first, please, and then you're the second.
Thank you very much, Rick, for enlightening us about the household finances. In the last week, we've seen GMAC, an icon in Australia that we all borrowed money from to buy our Holdens for the last umpteen years, close down. We've seen GE announce that they're pulling out of auto finance, some small business lending and some housing lending. The GE money's going strong. But is this the tip of the iceberg about the availability of credit? What concerns do you have there about the households not being able to buy their cars and get credit?
Well, there's been, after quite a few years of very strong growth in credit, recently credit growth has definitely slowed. In the case of the household sector, I think there's signs that it's stabilising in the range of 5 to 7% or so. In the last few weeks, again, we've seen more, particularly non-bank financiers, pull back from the market. This is all something we're keeping a very close eye on. It is important to ensure that there is adequate credit for the community. The question is, it all has to be taken into account in setting interest rates.
That question was asked by Digby Ross, the official receiver from Brisbane.
Hello.
Gentlemen there.
My name is Rulof Oosterveen. I'm a financial counsellor from Toronto, New South Wales. Basically, I was looking at your slides as you were presenting them, and the one that you presented that showed the relationship between income and debt as far as household was concerned, the income stream the major savings seemed to be in superannuation in that particular slide. Now, we'll go to our American friends and we'll pinch Joe the plumber. And Joe has now retired and he's living on his superannuation. Now, at the moment, superannuation in most cases, as we all know, is giving a negative return. So Joe's living on his superannuation and let's say he takes $35,000 a year out because that's what he was spending. Okay, if this particular crisis goes on for the next couple of years, that means that at the end of 2 years, Joe's going to have actually taken not only the loss on the super, what the fund has lost, but he's also going to take out $70,000 in living expenses. And my question basically is that how sustainable is that and how long can Joe keep going? Because we said that the shares and all that sort of thing were showing a return of about 7 or 8% over an average period of time. But as Joe's now retired and he starts eating into his capital, what difference will that make to his percentage of interest over a long period of time? And also as far as the relationship between what he has now and what he'll have in 2 or 3 years' time when the market starts to pick up again will be very, very different because his base capital will be very much lower because he's taken $70,000 out of his super to live on in that particular period of time. Thank you.
Well, you can't get away from the fact that returns on all these investments fluctuate over time. And I think the main mistake probably households make is that they factor in the returns from the good years and base their savings and living standards on those periods. In fact is, you have to do all your financial calculations on a much lower return than you get during those good periods. If you do that, you won't be any trouble. There won't be any trouble, basically. But it's very important for financial planners to not just rely on the returns from good periods in structuring people's affairs. They have to allow for the fact that there will be periods when returns are very weak. If you factor that in, work on the basis that returns over time are going to be basically 8% or so, and do all your calculations on that and make your financial decisions on that basis. You can't get away from that.
Back there, gentleman at the back, and I'll take one from down this corner somewhere. Next.
No. Andrew Robertson from the Late Line Business Program at the ABC. I was interested in your comments on the inflation overhang and the impact it might have on monetary policy, or the limitations, as you said, that it might put on monetary policy. Should we assume from that comment that the low point of the current easing cycle will be higher than the low point in the last easing cycle? And if so, by how much?
Well, I don't think we can assume anything at this stage. Basically, we're starting from a situation where inflation in the last quarter was at 5%. We are very confident that was the peak, and I think we're on the way down now. But there's a lot of uncertainties around, and inflation has got a long way to fall to go back into the target range. It's very important in the long run that that happens, because if inflation remains high, it really does start to distort the way the economy works. So, in setting interest rates, we will have to take into account how inflation comes down. Nobody can predict at this stage exactly how quickly it will come down or how low interest rates will go. That are just matters that have to be looked at and determined over time.
I'm having a bit of trouble with the lights in my face, but the gentleman there at the front.
Richard Symes from DR Capital. My question is there any safety measures put in place in case one of the major non-conformance lenders in the housing market goes down that isn't regulated or has that safety net that you've put in place for the banks? Because that will affect the household balance sheets and send it down to a major decline.
So I'm not sure I understood the question. Is there going to be a safety net for...
You've put up there previously about the defaulting on non-conformance loans, and the non-conformance lending market in Australia is if one of those non-conformance lenders, such as like GE or somebody, because of the US economy situations, has an effect on that where they have to close up shop, then isn't it going to have a flow-on effect to the rest of the market in Australia?
Well, those loans that those people are given, they're out in the market and they're fully funded. So, if they close up shop, it might mean there's no new loans coming, but it doesn't affect all the existing loans. Existing loans remain there. And they are fully funded and they'll be serviced and continue. So that won't be a problem for those people who have loans.
John Malewish of Ferrier Hodgson. There are many people believe that the cost of living has outstripped the number reflected by CPI. And last week, the Herald suggested that the calculation for CPI had become so complex that it was subject to manipulation. Do you have faith in the process that's being used to calculate CPI?
Oh, definitely. Look, the statistician does an excellent job in calculating the CPI. Look, I know most people always feel that the cost of living is rising faster than the official figures suggest, but that is just not the case. Basically, those figures are correct.
Jeff Weinstock, The Financial Review. You've laid out a very good case for why people should feel confident about the Australian economy and the state of households, but how concerned are you that the events of the last month will shake confidence and cut demand and lead to a significantly faster slowdown in the Australian economy?
Well, we just don't know what the effect of this is going to be. I mean, the effects have been so unusual. It's hard to tell what the effect's going to be, so we have to watch this very carefully over the next few weeks and months to see how things evolve. There's lots of anecdotes around at the moment about people being affected, but up until now, all the data, the hard data that we have come in, has basically been okay. Most of the data, of course, precedes the events of the last month or so, but as I say, it's just something we're going to have to watch. We're very alert to what the impact of this could be, but it's just a question of waiting.
Deputy Governor, from Dow Jones, the RBA intervention this week Should we take it now that the RBA has drawn a line in the sand around the 61 figure for the currency, or should we expect further interventions in the coming weeks? Thank you.
Well, as you know, the Australian dollar has fallen very sharply. It was only the middle of July that the currency was up in the well into the 90 cent range. And then last few days it got down as low as almost 60. So the bank has in recent times been intervening. The markets had become quite thin and illiquid, and movements in the exchange rate had been quite sharp, and we felt that in itself wasn't a good thing, so we were helping to stabilise the situation. The bank does not draw lines in the sand on currencies. The one policy we've always followed on the exchange rate intervention, ever since the currency was floated, was to buy the currency when it's low and sell it when it's high. We do that to stabilise the exchange rate. It has the side effect of being a very profitable operation. We've done that consistently for many years, and it's always worked, and we continue to follow that policy.
Catherine, you are a lawyer consumer advocate from Queensland's Legal Aid Office. Alan Greenspan said this week, if I've got it right, that he thought there was a flaw, that's an FLAW, in the economic model that they use to describe reality. I'm concerned, are we also looking to check for flaws in the economic model that we in Australia use to describe reality?
Well, my understanding of what Dr. Greenspan said was that I think he was acknowledging that he had put too much faith in the ability of the market to regulate itself. And in the United States in particular, over the last decade or so, they've had tremendous growth in new financial activity, like hedge funds and all sorts of things. And the consequences of that, I suppose, have ended up being quite negative in some respects. In Australia, I don't think we've ever had the same extremes of capitalism that they've got in the United States. Basically, a lot more of our financial sector is through the bank, financing takes place through the banking sector. So, I don't think we've got those sort of issues that the United States has. And as I say, in the case of the loan brokers, there's no doubt that inappropriate selling of housing loans through loan brokers in America was a big part of the problem. Here in Australia, we might have a very minor problem in that regard, but nowhere near the extent of the United States. And the measures the governments have taken to strengthen regulation of this recently, I think, will put us in a better footing going forward.
Peter Shepherd from Ferrier GKS. Mr. Battalano, you've mentioned that the bank's expectation is that inflation has peaked at 5%, well above its recent historical levels. Australia has a mixed history of managing inflationary expectations, and about 18, 19 years ago, we experienced a sudden crunch as inflation fell very rapidly in response to monetary tightening. What's the bank's expectation now about the future path of inflation and its consequent effect upon the real interest rates paid by the household sector?
Well, I think our forecasts are that over the next couple of years or so, inflation will come back to the target range of 2 to 3%. The question we always face as a central bank is how quickly do you try to get the inflation target back? Obviously, the more you tighten monetary policy and the more you slow the economy down, the quicker inflation will fall. But that can be very damaging to the economy, and so we face this constant dilemma of trading off those two things. In working out what to do, we are partly guided by what's happening to inflationary expectations. So the more signs there are that inflationary expectations are rising, the more important it is to get inflation back quickly. So far in this cycle, I have to say that inflationary expectations have been pretty well contained. You see it mainly in wage claims. Most people are still very happy to receive quite moderate wage rises. This is making the job of bringing inflation down much easier, and I think it also gives us a little bit more room for manoeuvre than might be the case otherwise. But broadly speaking, over the next couple of years, we still think inflation will come back to the target range.
Right. One last question, having regard to time. There's a very active hand waving over that side.
Thank you. Mike Norris from Max Recovery, based in the UK. One of the major issues that's started to worry people in the UK is unemployment. So I'd be interested to hear where you think unemployment in Australia is going over the next 18 months, 2 years.
Well, you know, if you work on the basis that the economy is going to grow below average for the next couple of years, it follows from that the number of jobs created will probably not be sufficient to absorb all those people wanting to enter the workforce, and there will be some moderate rise in unemployment. That happens from time to time. Since the early 1990s, we've seen very sharp downward movement in unemployment to, you know, what is now a record low figure. That hasn't been a smooth one-way downward trend. Along the way, there have been periods when unemployment has gone up again at various points in time. And the next couple of years or next year or two might be one of those periods. That's not to say that we're permanently going back to higher unemployment. The important thing is to get the economy back into a balanced situation, because that is fundamentally what keeps the economy growing over the long term. So I think it is likely that unemployment will rise a little bit over the next year or two. But as I say, that's not a sign of where we're heading over the longer term.
Thank you very much for a wide range of questions from delegates and others. Thank you, Mr. Battaglino, for giving us this thoughtful and far-reaching start to our task of unravelling the complexities. Delegates, I'd like to ask you to join with me in thanking Mr. Battaglino for taking his time from his busy schedule to be with us this morning. Now a little bit more housekeeping. We're housekeeping.